Welcome to Lock and Key Unlocked, a podcast about IDW's Lock and Key and now Netflix's Lock and Key. As we kick off with the very first episode of the series, I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And yes, it is finally here. Netflix's first season of Lock and Key, 10 episodes, is launching. Now, if this is your first time listening to Lock and Key Unlocked, we have a bunch of other episodes for you guys to check out in the Lock and Key Unlocked feed. We've been recapping every single volume of the series, as well as doing some special chats with Gabriel Rodriguez, the artist, Chris Ryall, the editor, and other things that are thrown in there. So please do check all of that out, but we are going to talk about the very first episode of the Netflix series. Before we get into it, though, I want to talk about your impressions. Pete, we were talking before we went on. Obviously, you were very nervous from watching the trailer because we care very deeply about the comic book series. Gabriel Rodriguez assured you it's all going to be okay. It's all fine, but talk me through this. What's going on in your mind, Pete?
All right. Well, first off, like, I hold this in very high regard. Like, you know, this to me is an unbelievable comic book that, like, it was perfect. The art's unbelievable. The writing's unbelievable. Not only is the start amazing, but it ends perfectly. And it's so emotional and such a journey that I was worried about what it's going to look like on television. And when I saw the trailer, I got very upset, angry, because it didn't look like what I wanted it to look like or what I thought the comic book was. And so, like, I really had to, like, I didn't want to put anything on it. So I had to, like, make sure that, like, I, like, did, like, a breathing session. I, like, set up a perfect place to watch it.
Wait, did you say a breathing session?
Yeah, like I had to breathe, like I had
for
to
the
like,
first
you know,
time.
Just like meditate and just kind of like, you know, like make sure that I wasn't bringing bullshit to this.
Real quick,
like,
can you walk us through what that means? I mean this seriously. What does a meditation from Pete LePage mean?
It's, you know, it's holding weapons in your hand and just breathing in a way that you feel connected and open,
just
you know, that kind of
couple follow-up questions on what you mean by weapons.
You know, just, you know how some people like to have like a blanket that they, you know, use, or, you know, like maybe a teddy bear or something, you know, something like that that's comforting to you.
So, so you have a security weapon.
Nunchucks or what was it?
Yeah, it's definitely my metal nunchucks. Yeah.
Great. So with all that out of the way, and then Justin will go over to you for your general impressions. How was it? Just broad strokes. Talking about this first episode, and we will break down all the individual pieces. How are you feeling right now, Pete?
I feel glorious.
Wow.
I'll tell you what. I was super nervous going into this podcast after how hepped up you were of the trailer. I'm so glad to hear that. That is a huge wave of relief for me, personally.
They did such a good job of, like, introducing you in a way that made you comfortable with who they were and what's going on. That, like, that moment in the car, like, really got me on board. And, like, they did such, and even like the opening credits with the animation and the music, like, so perfect. They did such a great job of sucking you into this world in a way that was really impressive.
Justin, what about you? What was your what meditative techniques did you do to get ready for this? And what happened next?
You know, I just, my normal TV routine is to, run, through the streets wielding my weapons just as a calming mechanism, which I obviously a katana, grappling hook.
Sure.
I'm like a,
nice,
I'm a
nice,
one man
dude.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle squad, just screaming, I'm ready to watch television before I go inside and sit and turn on the old tube. So once I was in that perfect mental state, I really liked it too. I was surprised. I guess maybe I'm a little more surprised than Pete. Like, I was more like, oh, this is quite different. Especially where it starts.
Where it started.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that because it's like, hey, let it go, man. This isn't the book. Like, we're doing something else.
Well, I think there's enough touch points that happen throughout it. In the interest of full disclosure, I'll say that I've watched the whole first season at this point for work, for my day job, so I can do some coverage. But this first episode, at this point, I've watched it three times, because the first time I watched it, I don't know that I was exactly halfway between you guys, but certainly I was very nervous about how they do it, like Pete. And I was surprised about all the changes, particularly that we know the story so well, to see things go differently. I love the direction. I love the writing. I love the cast, but it was hard to divorce myself from thinking, okay, this isn't Welcome to Lovecraft on screen. It's something different.
Right.
But right. By this third time going through it, which I was watching again to prep for us taping the podcast, I think it's a really good pilot, which is something that you wouldn't expect from Netflix, which is normally very decompressed. You're normally watching a 10-hour movie.
Yeah.
But to me, they do such a good job of setting up the stakes, setting up the cast, setting up the concept of the keys, setting up the house, everything that's going to go on in the season, even though it is an hour long and the rest of the episodes are actually sub 50 minutes, they're more broadcast TV length. This is a very good pilot for a TV series, which I appreciated a lot.
Yeah, I was surprised about just the way, maybe it's just the media moving to TV, but like I was totally connected to different characters. Mm. In the book, I like Tyler was the first character I locked onto, because you're in his head so hard.
Because of the name.
Tyler, yeah, I'm like, I like him. He's like me.
Yeah. My name is Alex Kinsey. That's my full name. So I've been always more connected to Kinsey.
Right.
Aw.
Yeah. And Pete, your name is Pete LaDodge. Is that right?
Yeah. So he connects with the villain.
Yes.
No. Bodie, man.
Also, we should mention Pete lives in a well.
Yeah.
Don't you say that, man. People should stay away from wells.
Yeah,
that is super clear.
One of the running themes of our podcast is that Pete is very nervous and fearful of wells.
I was walking through New York with Pete the other day, and we passed by a Wells Fargo, and he's like, not even that, cross to the other side of the street.
Too close.
Yeah, exactly.
Too close. And we should say also, Wells Fargo, when you give them your money, they put it in the bottom of a well. It's a very easy bank to break into.
It's very little. It's Wells and then Fargo, because your money falls so far in that well. It's gone.
Justin, you were saying, though, that you don't...
In the comic, I definitely connected first to Tyler and then later to the other characters. You were sort of in his head more as he's dealing with his loss and regret for his father. And in this pilot, I feel like you're with Bodie the most.
Yeah.
Right out of the gate.
Bodes.
Which is a really interesting switch. Tyler seems purposefully opaque and purposefully distant. So I thought that was really, that was to me the biggest change. Mm.
The other thing that I think, and we'll talk about this more as we go through the plot, but they do a very good job of setting up things for the life of the series in this first episode, that you have things like later on we meet the Savinis, which is a very different take on Kinsey's friend group, but they take a little more time to set them up because they show up much later on in the comic book itself. Or Tyler's friend group, same thing, or anything that's going on with Nina, to the opacity thing. Purposely, Nina is very held back through much of the first three volumes, I'd say. You know, you get a little bit of an entree, but there's so much more time spent with her here and what's going on with her to give her an ongoing mystery plot. It's something that feels very TV to me in a very smart way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also like really impressed with how this is so Netflix perfect. Like, it is binge worthy. Mm-hmm. I've never had an experience of like, oh my God, that first ep ended and I was like, I need more. I have to know. Like, it's so hard to stop in between. I've never like really felt the draw to like keep binging something like this.
Clearly you've never watched The Circle on Netflix, because oh man, binge worthy.
Wow. Alex, all in.
Yeah.
I haven't.
This is like dramatic The Circle. It's actually nothing like that. I'm
what
kidding.
A review. Put it on the novelization.
Should we jump into this? Should we start talking through the plot here?
Let's do
it. Sure.
Yeah. So this episode is called Welcome to Matheson. It's written by Joe Hill and Aaron Eli Collette. It's directed by Michael Morris. I'll give a little note here up top. because we get those changes right up front, it being called Welcome to Matheson instead of Welcome to Lovecraft. This is something that changed for, I believe, the Hulu pilot, actually. And it's because, I don't know how you guys know as much about this, but Lovecraft has sort of soured in the popular imagination since they released the first issue of Lock and Key. There's been a lot of talk about, hey, he actually was kind of a racist and had a lot of racist poems. So I think it's smart to change it to another horror icon, Richard Matheson, instead of H.P. Lovecraft going forward.
Yeah, and an interesting, like, sort of one-to-one change. Like, they could have just said, like, welcome to Key House or anything. But it's funny to do a sort of a full-on swap from writer to writer.
Well, this is another thing that I think points to, and I think it happens a little bit in this episode, but not to spoil too much, but like it does play out down the road, is we've talked a lot about things that didn't age as well in Lock and Key, the comic book, that were still well done, but didn't necessarily pan out. And they've made changes, I think, to be more considerate for 2020. And this is the first one of this. And I think that's great. I mean, that points to Joe Hill was very involved in the creation of the show, but he doesn't feel precious about his creation. He's willing to make those changes if they make sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I think that's not, this is sort of a larger topic, but like something we have a problem with in our culture a lot right now. It's like things in the past, we're meant to write off so much of like, oh, Lock and Key, they had that Lovecraft reference. We can't do it. And it's like, no, well, let's just change it. Like, let's update it. There's no shame in that. Would have been a shame to lose such a great story and series that we are getting to watch now for the sake of a couple of things that just times changed and old sort of bad ideas were there, and now we can move past them.
Yeah. So we do get these opening credits that Pete mentioned that I think are so charming. I love the theme. Love the look
of
it.
Very peppy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, my God. Not at all. Are you okay? He's crying. Pete, grab the nunchucks. Grab the nunchucks.
Good call.
I thought there was going to be a little more horror element haunting song, but it's just like a peppy sort of like CW style, like, here we go. Look at these keys.
I like it because it like not only do you get to see, it focuses on the keys, but it also does an animation, which is an ode to the comic book, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And although it would have been, part of me wanted Gabriel Rodriguez to draw that, but whatever. And then I felt like the music really set this tone of like, this is not just scary. There's a lot of wonder and hope in it. And I was like, this does a great job of pulling you in and getting you in a certain type of mood.
That's a great point. It's like wonder is a great to sort of swap out the more gory horror details for a sense of wonder and more like Bodhi-style childhood play and exploration, I think, is a smart change for what the show is maybe going to be.
Yeah. Well, I think I've seen a lot of talk about this. Fans worried, oh no, did they not lean into the gore? Did they not lean into the horror? And I've never really thought of Lock and Key as strictly a horror book by any means. It's much closer to dark fantasy. And like we talked about, there's so many different modes of the storytelling. It's funny at points. It's heartwarming at points. And I think if this was a straight horror show with blood and gore, like a lot of the first issue of Lock and Key, though it does have those different modes, that it wouldn't quite work as well. Leaning into that family-friendly type is a very smart decision.
Yeah, I agree. I've never felt like this is like a bloodbath type story. It's more just like a story that is super hard on its characters, which doesn't necessarily mean horror. Yeah. It's just like a character that, or a story that puts its characters through like hell, hell, nonstop, and so much tension that we're aware of all the bad things happening. And it's not the same as seeing someone's neck get cut open.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, the comic book has gory moments. It has those kind of scary, intense, you're jumping, you know, like, oh, shit, look out, like that kind of horror aspect. So it's definitely there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with that out of the way, let's actually jump into the first scene.
Well, wait, one more thing about this. Do you feel like it's a bit of a spoil to give away so many of the keys in the credit sequence?
Yeah, I was surprised at how much information was in those credits.
Because they really sort of explain each key visually, at least.
Yeah.
At the same time, you're seeing them.
I think that's okay. I like the idea because you don't, if you haven't read Lock and Key, you have no idea what any of that is. You don't know what it means. You don't know how it plays out or anything like that. So it's more of a tease. And certainly we don't get all of those in the first episode. So I think it's a smart thing from the Netflix binge perspective to get people interested. You see this music box, you don't see it in the first episode. You're like, I want to know what that is. I want to keep watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I think that's a good way to look at it. And I guess it's a nice reminder as you're binging. If you do watch the credits each time you start over, it's like, oh yeah, look at all those keys. We're going to see some of them in, we know what they are. We're slowly going to learn what they are.
Yeah. Overall, I was very much impressed with how much was packed in this first episode.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into that first scene because this is something that is completely original for the show. We've never seen this before.
I thought it was very smart that they started on regular keys because he's holding house keys.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
But you don't know. You don't know if they're regular keys on that. You didn't see them all.
That's true. But you introduced the concept of keys and locks, meaning a key goes in the door and opens it. Boom. We're there.
Right.
But I thought, I was like, holy shit, is that Randall Locke? Are we going to see this right away, like in the comic book? I was very scared early.
Like if you grew up in sort of a beaded door house, like if like a sort of a 60s commune
vibe,
you might not even know what a lock or a key is. And here we are, introduced to the
concept. I think that's a big problem, right? This man walks down the street, he pulls these things out of his pockets and he puts them into a thing. But what is it? You know, if you don't know, he needs to say, this is a key, I'm putting it in the lock, going in a door. Now I am inside. Now I'm sitting down.
That's ridiculous.
And there we go. Now we're all on the same page.
Yeah. You guys should really watch The Circle. That's what they do on that show.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's an accurate description of The Circle. It's a basic introduction of being a human over and over again.
It's kind of. What were you going to say, Pete?
I'm just saying, who do you think this is for? Like people who.
Babies.
Never.
It's for babies.
Used keys.
Oh, just because you grew up in a door-based community, Pete? Like, I don't know. Some of us lived a little differently, you know?
Yeah.
Igloos.
I'm just saying that, like, even the beaded curtains had ropes. You can tie them back every once in a while, bro.
This is great. Think, we're almost 20 minutes into this podcast, and we're up to a guy opening the door.
Yeah. Every moment matters, Alex.
I do want to talk about the scene, though, because it's a completely original scene for the show. Man gets called on the phone, is told Randall Locke is dead. He says he knows what he needs to do. He gathers a pick of some... actually, let me ask for some ground rules before we get into this. How much do we want to talk about just purely the show versus our knowledge of what's coming?
I was struggling with this as well. I think we should stick to the show because otherwise we'll spend the whole time being like, oh, it's just like this thing I saw. Or it'll be like, this is not like the thing I saw. Right. I think we should really focus on what we're seeing.
Right. As much as we can, I think. So man gets called on the phone. He gathers a pick of his friends. We see some floor plans. He pulls out this
key house.
He pulls out the key, jabs it into his chest. Flame courses through his veins and the house explodes and he dies. So this is a big, bold way to suck you right into the series.
Yeah, and not to go back on what I literally just said, but I don't know how this connects at all to anything from the comic series. This feels, I don't even know what it's touching on.
Yeah.
He said it was original.
Yeah, I know, but a lot of times it would be an adaptation of something. So that to me is exciting. I love the introduction of what I'm going to call the flame key right out of the gate and seeing what purpose
that was
it could have been.
I think that was the bomb key.
The bomb key.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with flame key as well. The other thing, the thing that I like about this and overall about this episode is about, we get this huge action-y thing right at the beginning. But at that point, there's really, other than a very quick glimpse of the ghost door, there's no magic for about a half an hour. And then after the first bit of magic in half an hour, there's nothing for another 15 minutes. And it isn't until the last 5 to 10 minutes of the entire hour-long pilot that we get this huge, exciting action suspense sequence. And I just love the structuring of that. I love it because it lets you sit with the characters, get sucked into everything, enjoy them before it starts throwing in the supernatural mystery again.
Yeah. And I do think this scene points to, this opening sequence points to a larger, maybe conspiracy side to Key House, or like the Keys. Because we have someone who we don't meet on the phone calling, and it feels like it's something they've planned for. Rendell Locke is dead, and he's like, I know what I have to do. So we don't know anything about this, but there's multiple people in multiple places involved in the mystery of Key House. So I think that's going to be very different. The original story felt like it was super isolated and focused on this one place. Well, this show is already opened up to a larger world.
Yeah. And then we cut to 3 months later, we meet Kinsey, Tyler, Bodhi, and Nina driving in the car. This is the establishment of our family. We touched on this a bit, but what did you guys think about this scene?
I was really moved by it. I think the car scene did a great job of like showing who's who, how everybody's feeling. Like everybody got a little time on camera, and it really set up this family as they're kind of driving to their new home. And like, I'm so happy because I was so worried, because Gabriel Rodriguez's art is so beautiful. You better take time during the show and like show us amazing things that would be like somebody drew it. And then when the mom's like, look, we're here, and Bodhi like wipes off the window and goes, whoa, and you see this wide shot of them like driving this picturesque road, and it's a beautiful moment. I'm so glad that they're doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think this was a great scene, and to meet the characters in the way we did, we didn't learn a ton about any of them. Like I said, I think Bodhi's sort of the one that pops the most. Kinsey, sort of get her vibe. She's drawing in the back. Tyler feels like the most distant, the most lost in his own world. Nina feels like she has it much more together than I would have expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I love this conversation they have. What's one sense you would get rid of if you had to?
Yeah.
What would you guys answer to that?
What's the one?
You got to say serious question first, Justin. Come
serious
on,
question.
Bro.
Serious
question.
Well, let me say, the reason I ask, we had the same conversation New Year's Eve this year, and it led to a very long alcohol-infused conversation that was like an argument at points. Like, it was a real conversation starter.
Oh, nice. Wow. Wait, what did you choose then? Why don't you kick it off?
I chose smell.
Oh, yeah?
Forget smell. Other senses, are you need those ones.
Yeah, but in a fire or something like that, that could really cost you, man.
How often are you in a fire?
Yeah. I would say my nose is usually pretty stuffed up, so I could probably do without smell as well. Certainly wouldn't want to get rid of sight or touch or taste or hearing. Maybe my sixth sense. I could get rid of my sixth sense because honestly...
Dude, you need that, man.
I guess. Yeah.
You see dead people.
I do. Yeah. What about you, Pete?
I would also say the same thing, because what is it? Andy Serkis. He doesn't have smell.
Andy Serkis?
No. The Sudeikis.
Jason Sudeikis.
Jason Sudeikis.
Jason Sudeikis. Yeah.
Oh, and so he's fine. He's fine. And so you.
He's fine. He's doing great, man. He's got a family. He's doing. Yeah. He's got a career. He's living the life. He can't smell shit.
I would. That is such a funny thing. Such a funny reference to me.
New York would be so much better if you couldn't smell, man. Come on.
Yeah, I guess we're biased. We all live in New York. I would argue there's people all around the world who are missing every sense. One sense of each sense that are also living fine. But Sudeikis, he's funny. He's doing well.
What I liked about this scene instead of the car, just to get back to that for a moment, is I think they do just a nice, subtle job of setting up the family dynamic here, where it could be stilted. It's very hard to take a bunch of actors who don't really know each other, throw them in a car, and make them work. But it feels very natural. It feels like a natural family conversation, and that's what you need out of this scene. Yeah. The other thing that you get, that we get a little bit more of as we go, and I think to the point of holding back on the blood and gore, they're nowhere near as bloody as it was in the first issue of the book, but we get Nina flashing back to the night Rendell was murdered, which we see more of later, and I like how they parse out this information through Nina's flashbacks. I think it's smart.
I was worried because it was 3 months, and I was like, oh my God, we're going to skip the death. And I was so excited because I was like, yeah, we don't have to relive that horrible thing that happened to this family. They're just going to go past it. And then we still got it. And I was like, oh, no.
And I love the way throughout the episode we get the different points of view. We get Tyler's point of view on it. And it really it set the death of Rendell Locke up as the organizing event and catalyst of what put everything in motion to put them at Key House for what we're about to see.
Yeah. So then the next scene, as we mentioned, they drive into Matheson. We get established in Matheson. It looks perfectly right as a little small town. And they go to get some ice cream. And a couple of quick things happen here. First of all, Bodhi, though we don't meet them until later on, sees Rufus and his mom, Ellie, on the street, which
is
fun.
I got choked up.
It's great.
So as soon as I saw Rufus, I was like, oh, God.
It's great. I like them setting up the action figures early, the G.I. Joes or whatever they are, which is awesome. And then they go into the ice cream shop and we get another little change for the book. But I think, again, a very smart change. Scott is working there. Scott is a character from the book. He seems a little different here. He's not as much a Spider Jerusalem English punk, though he does have the English accent. And he gives them free ice cream. And another, not necessarily subtle, but well done, smart thing is he gives them the ice cream and says, discount, you know, it's free on the house for the family. They're like, we don't need your pity. And he's like, no, it's to welcome you to Matheson. And I think it very well, very simply sets up the Locke family's relationship to Matheson, where they're going to be very standoffish, at least at first. And it also sets up Scott as this very welcoming entity, particularly towards Kinsey.
Yeah, and he's not as obsessed with her as he was in the book. He's just like a slightly weird kid who puts himself out there.
No, he's straight up stalks her. Later, he finds where she's eating. She's like, he's like, I've been looking for you everywhere. So yeah, he's pretty obsessed.
But he's less. It's less like, I need to be dating you, or I love you, or that vibe. And more like, oh, I'm interested in you. I want to help you.
I think so.
That's the way I took it anyway.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's slightly on the wrong side of stalking a little bit because he is following around and just talking to her all the time. But at the same time, to your point, Justin, I think this Scott is mostly about welcoming Kinsey into town. Yeah. He wants her to be happy, wants to be welcoming to her. And he sees it like a project that he could kind of work on, I think. So he gives them the free ice cream and then they get to Key House. Let's stop there for a second. What did you think about Key House? What was your thought about that?
It was cool. It was more. It was much more colorful than the Key House in the book, and felt more like it just like pops out of the horizon, almost storybook. It gives it already this sort of fantastical vibe. The Key House I'd always imagined was a little bit more like darker, mysterious, haunted housey.
Tyler does a great way of kind of like summing it up, but it is like both beautiful and creepy at the same time. But it does have this ominous feel because it's like they're literally driving to it and it's the only thing for miles and it's kind of in this clearing. So super creeps.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you note about the colors because in the book, I believe it's mostly reds and blacks. And here there's a lot more greens. Lighter reds. I think you're right. I didn't really pick up on the storybook thing, but I think you're absolutely right about that. And then we get another smart TV thing, I thought, where Uncle Duncan shows up. He gives them party hats. Bodhi is hanging on his leg very briefly, which is very fun. Yeah. And we get a tour of the house. And like the establishment of the family, to me, this is just such a smart TV thing to do, is geographically walk us through all the places we're going to continue to explore over the course of the show and just set it up. I like that quite a bit.
Yeah, me too. Especially, like, this is the whole premise of Locke and Key is hard in television. It's hard to introduce and hard to establish, like, hey, this is going to be a pretty wild magic story where keys are magic and here's how they all work. They all work slightly different. So I do think getting as many details sort of on the table in such a smart way really sets us up for success. I mean, they can't rely on most viewers having read so much of the material coming into episode one.
I mean, the large majority of viewers, because it is Netflix, are not going to. You know, they... Yeah. Just click on stuff. They're looking for the new thing that weekend that's featured. So if anything, I think the great thing about this is because the show is so strong, people are going to go back, hopefully, and read the books after this and find a new, fresh take on the story. But yeah, they're going to have no idea. They're going to see the camera pass by the ghost store. You get that ominous tone as Tyler walks past it, but there's no explanation. Unlike the first issue of the series, we don't see the ghost key. We don't see what happens with the ghost store or anything like that. It's just a tantalizing bit of information.
One thing also in this sequence, Tyler and Kinsey feel very much closer in age. They feel like a little bit more of a unit. When I sort of, I've always seen them as three separate sort of pods. And this feels that they are almost like tandem in a way.
Yeah. If they had revealed that they were twins or something like that, I wouldn't necessarily have been surprised. I think Tyler is still supposed to be older than Kinsey. But yeah, to your point, I like that choice too. I mean, it feels like what they do later on is they lean a little bit more into teen drama area. And that maybe part of that is aging Kinsey up a little bit and maybe aging Tyler down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like the fact that a lot of them are having these flashbacks is very interesting storytelling in a way that, like, letting you know that this really still is affecting them so much.
So after the tour and after Uncle Duncan does some sweet, sweet puns, which actually are something taken right from the book.
Yeah.
I mean, not those exact puns, but just the Locke family doing terrible puns. Tyler goes out and is very awkwardly smoking at the Cliffs, like it is the first time he's ever smoked a cigarette. Kinsey comes up and talks to him. And they have a very sweet conversation and end up taking a selfie for their dad, which Nina, as she puts Rendell's urn full of his ashes on the mantle, gets the text from the kids and flashes back to the night it all happened. I know I skipped past a bunch of things there. So before we get into the flashback proper, any notes on those?
Yeah. Was he smoking a cigarette or was he smoking weed?
Yeah, I thought it was
weed?
A joint. It was a joint. But also, so, like,
hey,
the
Alex,
way...
be cool, all right?
I mean, I'm a cop, so I just got you guys. You know what joints are.
Tyler's smoking one of those jazz cigarettes out on the cliff.
Some of the devil's lettuce there. Yeah, so, like, I just like the fact that he couldn't light it. Like, he was shaking and, like, you know, having a hard time, like...
And what I like about it, if it indeed was weed, and the reason I say that is later, Kinsey calls out Tyler for having red eyes. So I do think that if he's sort of performatively trying to smoke weed to deal with his the trauma of his father's death, like, I think that's just such a good character choice and sort of the thing of, like, a teenager doesn't know what to do. So it's like, well, maybe I can just be cool and just, like, be high and let that fix my problems. Yeah. And to do all that with just this him not being able to do it and not over-explaining it, I thought was just such a cool scene. The drowning cave that we see below is super scary and way farther down than...
Yeah.
So I love that. That whole scene, I thought, was just one of the smartest uses of time in this
pilot. Yeah, yeah, because you really got a lot of who Tyler is and kind of what he's going through, and you do get to see the cave. Because he's moved so much, like, he was going to spark it up early, but then sees this amazing view and is, like, kind of drawn towards it a little bit. And, you get so much about their relationship, their dynamic, and... yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes of the first ep.
So then we do get this flashback as Nina gets the picture of Kinsey and Tyler, and we get a lot of information there. There's a little bit of a change to profession with her, I believe, where she is repairing some stained glass windows. She's painting them, and that's something that I think she's doing with Key House a little bit later on as well.
Yeah, it made me think, do they flip houses?
I think so.
Rendell and Nina. Yeah. So that's interesting. And I think it does connect her more to the house a little bit just from a creative.
She does say she needs a project. So yeah, if she flips houses, this would be a perfect fixer upper for her.
Well, it does sound like that's what Duncan wants, that their plans on them doing is fixing the house up and then selling it. So and
I think thematically, that's also such a smart move for Nina because she is so tied to mending and fixing things, and to make that part of her job, part of her character that she can do throughout the season. I like that quite a bit. If she's trying to fix the house, if she's trying but can't fix herself, that's a good thematic thing to lay in for her.
And one thing before we go into the flashback, I love that they text a picture to their dad's phone number, even though he's dead.
Yeah.
Because that was such a cool choice, interesting choice, that connection to something beyond, I think, sets them up as like thinking a little bit differently and like moving past logic and being like, no, this makes us feel better. Like the emotion of doing that for no other reason than to feel like they still have that connection sets them up as being perfectly ready to handle the magic they're about to confront.
Also, like, yeah, and I completely agree with that. But then also, like, it's so funny because the mom is having a moment with the urn where, you know, her husband is, and then the text comes up and it's for her dad, and the look on her face for their dad, her husband, is just like, holy crap. And she looks back at the urn like, did you just do this?
Yeah. It's fucked up.
It's very sad. We do get the flashback. We get to see Sam Lesser coming in, pointing a gun.
Oh, my God. A perfect Sam Lesser. So creepy in all the right ways. Holy shit.
Here's a crazy thing that I found out while tweeting with some of the folks behind the scenes. Thomas Mitchell Burnett, I think that's his name, who plays Sam Lesser, actually played Rufus in the Hulu pilot, and they liked him so much, they recast him as Sam for the show.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes into what Gabriel Rodriguez was talking about during our show when we interviewed him, was this idea that, like, they needed those failures to kind of get things right to get to this place.
Well, because also like we only see him briefly, but Kobe Bird, who plays Rufus, is so great and so perfect as well, and we'll see more of him as the show goes on.
I was off put by how in the comic Sam Lesser feels like a little bit ageless or a little bit outside of, he's not like a normal kid, a normal looking kid because of the way he's drawn. And this is like, oh shit, he's a kid.
Yeah.
He walks in and, you know, shoots Nina, which is also a change. And that was a big surprise. And then kills Rendell, and it's like a child doing it. And that was more unsettling. In the book, you already know he's going to be, he has issues, and you see it coming a little bit more. And this was like, whoa. So that was interesting.
Well, and I think that sets up a little bit. He becomes much more sympathetic, even in a very effed up kind of way later on in the book. And I think that plays into the casting as well. To your point, he looks younger. He looks the same age as Tyler, which is what he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Then we get one of the most iconic scenes in Lock and Key. Bodhi wanders out of the house, goes to the well, takes a Polaroid photograph, drops it. The photo pops right back up, and he says, hello, are you my echo? And the echo says, yes, I am Bodhi. I thought they executed this perfectly.
Okay. I felt like it was so awesome. The first episode could have ended there. It was like such an amazing moment.
Well, they're about 20 minutes in, so that would have been kind of short. But.
No, but I'm just saying, like, just how dramatic of a moment that was. And it, like, that's almost kind of like a fade to the back roll credits moment. It's so powerful, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, you just bump up the dan, 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 dan.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Back in black?
Yeah.
Nice. That would have been a wild choice.
I couldn't tell if you were doing Thunderstruck or Back in Black. It was a little
whatever you want to do.
Okay. I love the choice to give him the Polaroid camera and have that be playing out this whole time. And great scene.
The framing shot of, like, you see the well, it's right in front of you, and then the three windows that are just open with kind of bars on it, and then Bodhi's trying to kind of squeeze through that one window. It's just such an amazing shot, and I feel like belongs in a comic book. It's like so.
Yeah, someone should do a comic book of that.
Yeah, it's just the cinematography. I'm so happy they're doing shots like this. I was so worried it was going to be focused on the people and the action. The fact that they're
still doing
tonal shots and like really committing to the art of the comic book is just so great.
Now, Pete, are you afraid of regular holes in the ground as well? Or is it purpose? Is it specifically little holes with little bricks circles around them?
Yeah, it's strictly wells. But yeah, if I see like a giant hole in the ground, I'm not going to go anywhere near that either.
And it's also H.G. Wells stories, right? Because I tried to give you that copy of The Time Machine and you threw it back at me.
Yeah. Not for me.
So a couple of things happened really quickly. We mentioned the conversation where Duncan and Nina are talking about the house. Duncan doesn't like it, but he's not sure why. Nobody believes Bodhi about the well or the echo.
Oh,
which also so straight out of the book. And then we get a great scene in the morning that I think continues to do a really good job of establishing Nina, or this take on Nina. She's making breakfast for them and it's very bad, which
yeah,
I thought was very fun. She is unable to handle anything. Clearly the kids are handling everything. Kinsey gets a little bit of a new look. And it paced out throughout it, bringing the family back together versus sending them off on these separate missions, really emphasizes the bond there very nicely.
Yeah, I agree. I also like the, when the Nina and Duncan are talking, she mentions Brian, which I believe is Duncan's partner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the comic, I think Duncan was hiding that he was gay. And in this, he's out to the family anyway. And I thought that was like a nice update to the character.
Yeah.
The sequence of Bodhi busting and flipping off the house, I thought was also very funny.
This is
the Aloha moment was so great. And it was such like a little kid, like once they have a fun thing like that, the fact that they don't let go and they keep doing it.
Aloha bit is great, but to me, it almost means more than just the bit, because that was the moment to me that crisped in that, at least with this first episode, what I think they're going for, which is it felt very Goonies to me that you have this like very dirty but clean joke that plays out throughout. It's so funny the way Jackson Robert Scott delivers the Aloha later on, flipping off Nina and saying Aloha. Hilarious, but
very fun.
Like, it makes it more treasure hunty and makes it more adventure-y, and it is like the Fox pilot was produced by Steven Spielberg, and I think they got towards this but not all the way, but this really does capture that old Amblin Entertainment style of adventure so well, and I think that humor is part and parcel of it.
Goonies is such a good touchstone. I hadn't thought of that before, but it's great and spot on, where there's magic everywhere throughout the journey, and it's just walking into the next piece of it. And I feel like that's the way this show is going to sort of spill out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we get some scenes at Matheson Academy. Kinsey overhears a girl that we later learn is Eden, and another girl, I keep blanking on her name, I'll look it up later, that Tyler hits on at the party. They're talking about Kinsey, don't realize she's listening, but it clearly puts her off, so that Kinsey is hiding under the stairs, as we mentioned earlier. Scott has a very sweet, funny conversation with her about Sriracha and Felonia, and explains that he is part of a group called the Savinis, inspired by the master of modern gore, and they love horror and invites her to come over, which I like the scene quite a bit. I thought that was fun. I thought the note about your Hogwarts letter is never going to come written there. Yeah. It just makes the whole school, like the house, feel more lived in.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we also get Tyler playing hockey. In the middle of that, he flashes back to Rendell being killed. And then the flip side of it, two dudes who he plays hockey with are like, dude, it's so cool that your dad was killed. You're going to totally get laid at this party.
Yeah.
Which felt very teen to me in exactly the right way.
Brinker. We get Brinker the jerk right there out of the gate.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I love having him there. He's such a good like 80s style rich kid movie villain. And he's well cast.
Yeah. Now, let's get to the next thing, because there's another big change for the TV series that I'm curious to get your beat on. But we get Bodhi skating around the house. We get that fun Aloha moment.
Wheelies
with Nina. He's like, nope, don't want to go into town with you. Thanks so much. Stays back. He's watching TV, eating sugary cereal.
Which point, living the life.
He hears some whispering. And this is, technically speaking, a big change from the books, where he finds out from the Echo, the lady in the well, She explains the keys, say they whisper to special people, go find me these keys, find all the keys in the house. So the keys whisper. What do you think about this?
So this was one of the things that I was really worried about because I spotted it in the trailer. Now, they did have the whispering iron in the book. So, like, it's not, I mean, it's still kind of a part of it, but the keys whispering is completely different. I was at first disappointed, but then seeing it in action, I feel like that's cool because that way, you know, if they've got to get to things, if they're not trying, you know, because it's like, what are they trying to fit into this first season? So it's like, I think it's a great shortcut that really helps kind of talk about how special Bodhi is and how he's the really important to this family.
I think it works. To me, the cat, like finding the keys by accident always, that makes a little bit more sense and makes it a little harder to find them. Mm-hmm. Since so much of the story is like, God, we got to find these keys. It's hard to find keys. If my car keys were whispering to me, I would never lose them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a smart TV choice. I understand where you're coming from, Justin, but I think in terms of keeping the action going and it seems it's a short lift from saying it's made out of whispering iron, which we don't know yet in the TV show, to saying, oh, what if the iron actually whispered to people? It removes a little bit of the treasure hunt thing, but you still get those things of Bodhi wandering through the house, going into that gross drain and pulling out a key and all these other things. And
yeah, great place to keep a key in a garbage disposal.
Oh, I hate that.
I hate reaching into a garbage disposal. Very horrifying. I agree with you. It also will help point if it's like Bodhi can hear it because he's the youngest and the most like available magical to believe in fantastical things. And then if the other kids start to tune into that, because it seems like they can't hear the keys at first. Mm-hmm. And as they fall deeper into the mystery of the house, they'll start to hear the keys whispering. I think that's very cool as well, as if the power to hear them spreads through as you get more drawn in.
Yeah, but we don't know if they'll be able to hear the whispering yet.
I bet they will.
Okay.
So then we get the establishment, the first official key, which is the Anywhere key. Bodhi discovers it's in Kinsey's bracelet, breaks it out.
Yeah, but what's great, they showed that bracelet before, and you mm-hmm. can kind of see a little bit of a key, so I'm so glad that they kind of did that because they gave us a little hint and then didn't make us wait too long. And then we're like, yeah, the bracelet.
Yeah. And so he breaks it out of there. He wants ice cream. It doesn't quite work. And then he uses the key in the door, of course, is able to use the Anywhere key to go right to Scott's ice cream shop, steal some vanilla ice cream from him.
Yeah. Doesn't pay for it. Smooth about it.
Little jerk.
Scamp.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he got free ice cream from before. I think he's just, you know.
He just thinks ice cream's free.
Yeah. There you go. Totally reasonable. We also mentioned about aging. They certainly aged Bodhi up a little bit, but I think Jackson Robert Scott is so perfect for the role, it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that the way they show the Anywhere key and he goes to the ice cream shop, which we've already seen before. Like, it was such a well set up whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice.
And then they immediately find out. Bodhi goes back, says, I got this key. It could take me anywhere. And Kizzy says, fine, take me to the Eiffel Tower. And it doesn't work. So she, of course, doesn't believe him. As we find out later on from the Echo, you need to have seen the door to be able to travel to the door, or there at least needs to be a door there. I like that. I mean, that's right from the books, but I like that because it establishes there are rules about the keys. They can't do just anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right around here, I think we see the high school photo of Rendell and the gang from the past. That was so cool to see. And obviously, we don't know anything about that now. Very much more chill, regular photo than we've seen in the comic.
Yeah. We also get an important thing here where Kinsey is talking to Nina about it, and they're clearly clashing. You know, as much as this is a
so
family.
So harsh.
Yeah.
So harsh.
Well, they've gone through this traumatic experience, and if I was to venture a guess, part of the theme of the entire series, for however long it goes, is bring this family back together. You know, because that's what the book is about as well, is can they fix themselves after the trauma of their father being murdered in front of them? And that's kind of an open question, but I think it does lead to clashes like this where Kinsey doesn't understand why they're in Matheson.
Also, yeah. Like, such a great line. Like, such a great line to be like, you know, Dad never spoke in platitudes like this. And it like, says so much about their relationship, and in such a small amount of time, shows so much.
So then we get the second new key of the episode, entirely new here. Bodhi hears whispering. As he said, he reaches into the garbage disposal. I'm so glad I have never had a garbage disposal, because horrifying. But he finds this key, talks to the echo. And another thing that I want to call out here, because we go back to her, is I love the way they slowly reveal the actress as Echo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like, in kind of horror movies, in scare, anytime someone puts their hand in a garbage disposal, it ends horribly. So, like, that moment of just, like, sticking his hand in this garbage disposal, I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely awful. So the Echo explains to him, the Echo tricks him, and he says, I want to see my dad again. Is there a key that can do that? And she says, oh, if you use the mirror key, there's you can see the dead again. Yeah. And uses very careful words there. Before we get back to that, before we get to the mirror key, though, we hop over to a high school party. Tyler is talking to a girl at the party. Eden interrupts. They hook up, but as they're hooking up, Sam pops up and he freezes up and he can't do it. I like the scene quite a bit for Tyler, because it shows very clearly the trauma that he is going through in a very different way than we saw it in the comic book.
Yeah. I just want to go back 1 second and just say, like, the fact that, you know, at this point, we just know her as the Echo, like, saying, like, show it to your mom was such a powerful, creepy line as well.
Yeah, I feel like the Echo's trying to get the adult out of the way.
Yeah.
Because the Echo feels like she can handle the kids a little bit easier. Obviously, she's telling Bodhi whatever she wants, and he's doing it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, about the Tyler scene, yeah, it's... we're not in Tyler's head. We just are sort of watching him. And this was a good way, rather than have him like frozen in time and not able to act at anything, he's at least out there trying to be a normal kid, but unable to do it because of the trauma.
And then we see the same thing on the flip side with Kinsey, where she makes her first visit to the Savinis. We meet all of Scott's friends. There's only two other friends that he has, four total, including Kinsey, which he's immediately thrown by. I will mention as a little note, because we do a Riverdale podcast called Riverdale After Dark. One of the Savinis is played by Asha Bromfield, who is Melody Jones on Riverdale. Don't know if you guys picked up on that, but there you go. A little bit of Josie and the Pussycats action going on.
Now, as we've talked about previous on this podcast, there in the comic book, we were drawn in as different characters. The character of LePage is one of the friends of Scott with one T. Is the guy on the ladder the Pete of the Lock and Key TV series?
I think he has a different name. I think he has a different name.
I got cut out of the TV show, guys.
No, man, and replaced with just another dude.
No, you can totally play teen, buddy. Absolutely.
No, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Would you want, if they were like, hey, Pete, come play a teenager on the show, would you do that?
Hell yeah. Are you kidding me?
They'd be like, great. You're way too old. All right.
De-aging software. They definitely spend the money to get one of us in there.
I also like this scene. Yeah, take that Irishman money and put it to de-aging Pete, very specifically to play a teenager on Lock and Key. So I like the scene as well, because they're watching a horror movie. I think it's Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and they're just ripping it apart, just having a great time. They start talking about Final Girls, and Kinsey walks out. And flips out at Scott and is like, no, final girls aren't like that. Sometimes they freeze. Sometimes they're too scared. That's not how it happens in real life. And Scott, of course, is a dumb idiot that he was like, come watch this bloody, gory horror movie. And I liked I love how the actor who's playing Scott is playing it, because there's a softness and sweetness to him that wasn't necessarily present in the book.
Oh, yeah, it was there. It was just more hidden, I feel like.
Yeah, that's and he just keeps making mistakes because he's a kid, and he very blindly walks into like continually harming this relationship that he really wants to go well.
Yeah. By the way, I looked up his name. It's Patrice Jones, but I think he's doing a great job. I ship him. I ship him with Kinsey already, guys.
Yeah.
There we go. But yeah, she walks home. Tyler picks her up. And then we head into our final sequence here, which is the big action suspense sequence. Bodhi uses the mirror key and immediately sees a super creepy, super evil Bodhi.
Run away!
So creepy.
Oh, my God.
Run away!
Now,
all of this was really well done.
I assume most viewers realize this, but Jackson Robert Scott played Georgie, the little yellow raincoated kid from It, who says, "We all float down here." And is horrifying in that movie. He worked with Andy Muschietti, who directed It, who directed the Hulu pilot. So such a great holdover. I love that he's pure and innocent and funny, except for this one moment in the mirror, which is like, oh, right, that's Georgie. I remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's in the mirror. Nina walks up. She sees her double, Darby Stanchfield, also doing a great job being horrifyingly creepy in the mirror.
Yeah.
And she walks into the mirror and gets lost into this mirror world. I just want to like sort of brush through the sequence so that we can go back and talk about the different bits of it.
Okay.
But Bodhi gets scared. Echo says, "Quick, give me the anywhere key," and escapes. So they're left on their own. Tyler ultimately goes after Nina in the mirror. He has a rope tied around him. There are skeletons in there. So, in fact, people have died in the mirror world. And Tyler and Nina close their eyes, find each other again. They pop out of the mirror. Nina immediately forgets, and they say, "What is this place?" And then there's one scene after that, a tag, which we'll get to in a moment. But let's talk about this whole mirror sequence. What did you think about it? What was going on? What was your general impression? Because, again, totally original for the show.
Yeah, the key's new. The whole scene's new. Like, I love the way it added the creepy element that, like, this is a dangerous thing. And then all the characters wander into it, which is something I feel like that's going to happen over and over again. The fact that Echo just takes advantage of the situation and the plans are working for her, really like that. We know she's a threat. We don't know how to stop her. She just twists Bodhi around. And then the fact that they're all exposed to magic immediately and together, it was great. And it was such a fun way to use the same devices of the ghost door that happened in the original story and bring it in for everyone, still make it scary and dangerous, but have it be all the kids are on the same page at the same time.
Yeah. No fucking way I would walk through a fucking creepy-ass mirror. So that was just weird to me, like why the mom would do that.
I think it draws you in. That's pretty clear based on the magic. Like Bodhi seems to be able to resist it, but the way that Darby Stanchfield plays it, it feels like almost the spell comes over Nina where she just starts walking into the mirror. That's the only thing she can do.
I'd walk through a mirror.
Yeah.
You couldn't pay me enough. If the my reflection is creepy and then it's like, follow me? No, hell no.
You don't trust yourself?
Like, I'm not an evil mirror version of myself. Hell no. Not with a wicked face. If I was more happy and there was like more sunshine behind my reflection, then maybe. But it was super evil and creepy. But yeah, it was kind of crazy how it was like the mom just kind of like went ghost face and then walked in. But I did love the touch of like Bodhi opening the door after Echo leaves and grabbing the rope, like such a smart kid thing to do.
Yeah. I do think, on this, why she walked into it, I think the place was called, the place of self-reflection or something.
Yeah.
And I think the Locke family is especially vulnerable to that. And maybe that's why she was drawn in so quickly because she hasn't been able to deal with these horrible events. And so the going to a place where all you have is to figure out your walk through your problems or obsess about your problems makes sense why she was drawn immediately into it.
Yeah, I love the sequence overall. I mean, I think to that point, also when she touches the mirrors, they break. which is she can only get so close to self-reflecting before it starts to break her into a million pieces. And that ultimately Tyler and Nina close their eyes and they need to trust each other and rejoin each other as a family. They have that hug and fall out of the mirror, I think, from an emotional level is so smart because it doesn't get them all the way to catharsis, but it is what you need to do in that first episode of the show to bring them part of the way there.
Yeah, like you can't, if you try to deal with these horrifying problems by yourself, you can easily get lost with them. If you close your eyes, get out of your own head for a second and open up to your family, then you can move forward and be rescued. And I think that they just physicalized showed us that rather than having to tell us that. And I think that, to your point, Alex, is setting up how they will succeed throughout the rest of the season.
That's deep, man. That's real deep. I also was worried when they got out of the mirror and the mom wasn't acting normal. I was like, oh my God, I hope she's not some creepy, like, evil mirror version of herself. Like one of the, you know, you see so many of her in that mirror. I was like, maybe they grabbed the wrong mom.
No, I don't. That's not what it was. I mean, I think, you know, we know what's going on. We're not going to talk about spoilers, but.
I realized that, but I had just had a moment where the mom wasn't. Like, I was waiting for maybe that creepy smile would come back. But that just, like, talks about how tense that moment is and how well they're kind of playing with it.
Yeah, I love this whole sequence. I love how it was filmed. I love the music in it in particular is great. And then they amp up the music even more for this last scene where we get to see Sam Lesser. He's in prison, and somebody has come to visit him. And, of course, it's the Echo. And she says, I told you I would come see you. And that's how we had the episode. To your point about keeping it binge-worthy, if you don't know the story, I love this moment because why would you think these two people are working together or knew each other? Yeah. And that really starts to bring together the mystery of the show in a big way.
Yeah.
Unbelievable ending.
So that all said, let's unlock our key moment for this episode. Pete, we'll start with you. What was your key moment in this episode?
I really feel like it was the joint on the cliff's edge moment where it was like you get to see the where a lot of shit's going to go down. Like they tease that, but they do it in such a beautiful way of like even though there's so much horrors in that cave, it's also kind of beautiful in drawing the main characters to that. So like and the fact that he's so messed up he can't use a lighter is I just felt like that was such a key moment and so beautiful and powerful.
Justin, what about you? Key moment?
For me, it was Bodhi on his wheelies rolling around the house.
Yeah.
Really, I love wheelies. Can you believe these wheels in his shoes?
It's crazy. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Did you see the like dust marks from when he was like, that's like how dirty it is?
Yeah. Very cool little production choice for that. But I do think it establishes him as sort of the central figure in the show, the catalyst, the fact that he is sort of he's the youngest. He's the most able to believe in the Key House. He is going to set everything in motion. He's the most easily tricked by Echo, but he's also the one who will bring them the keys. He's the Keymaster. He is the Keymaster.
I love that. I just want to say one quick thing, though, that we didn't really talk about. Is in the flashback, we got to see the kind of murder of the dad a little bit. But I was kind of laughing a little bit that Tyler was locked out and he couldn't get in.
You were
because
laughing?
He didn't have the key. Well, he didn't have the key. He was locked out because he forgot keys. Yeah. And I was like, all right, guys, okay.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the scene that establishes locks and the first scene establishes
keys. How important keys are.
And now, see, keys,
it
you
all
need
comes
keys.
Together.
Also, it was a little weird to me that it was like, oh, okay, the bad guy runs out the back door. And I'm like, Tyler, this is your house, right? You should know about the back door.
Jesus, you're coming hard for Tyler this episode.
Coming hard.
Mikey moment, which I already mentioned, is the Aloha joke, because that was the thing that really made me feel like, okay, I get what they're going for. Pete's giving me the finger right now. Hello right back to you, Pete. Hello.
Aloha.
It's so funny. I keep thinking about that. It's so well delivered, but it really just, it elevates the whole thing to another level in a very clear way, and I love that. So if you'd like to support our podcast, patreon.com/comicbookclub. We do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater Loft in New York. Come on by and we will chat with you about Lock and Key. Socially, Lock and Key Pod on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, iTunes, Android, Spotify, or Stitcher, or the app of your choice. Please subscribe. Also comment on Lock and Key Unlocked on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and more. We will be recapping every episode of the series. Pete and I had a little bit of a tiff about it in the last episode, so I wanted to clarify. New episodes are going to be going up every, what do you think, 5 hours, Pete? Something like that?
Fuck yep. you.
Yeah. No, we'll aim to put them up at least once a week, if not more frequently, so stay tuned for all that.
Thank you, once a week.
Maybe every 2 hours, I think now, is the pace for the episodes.
And aloha, motherfucker.
Keep it locked right here.